KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. We're long overdue for a catastrophic disaster based on studies of Earth's past. Scary? It probably should be, considering that during our most recent disasters, more than 75% of the planet's species died out. Science journalist Annalee Newitz talks about how, even though catastrophe may be inevitable, humans' chances for survival are better now than ever. She spoke at Town Hall on May 22, 2013.
Well, thanks so much for coming out to hear about the end of the world. And thanks to the Town Hall for putting on this amazing series. It's so terrific that there's public science education going on like this, especially in a time when funding is being cut to sciences at the national level, so we need to keep pushing for as much science education as possible. So I've just finished writing an optimistic book about the apocalypse, and it didn't start out that way at all. I really did not realize that this book was going to have a happy ending, and it actually started because I've been really fascinated my whole life with stories about destruction, especially massive global destruction and apocalypses, and everything from kind of the underground cannibal apocalypse to zombie stories and Godzilla stories. Godzilla is kind of one of my spirit animals, and I wanted to. A couple of years ago, when I was thinking about this, I thought, well, how could I write a kind of nonfiction version of a Godzilla movie? And what would that look like? You know, if we delved into, you know, the scientific literature and what history has to teach us, you know, what would be the equivalent of some kind of massive destruction caused by a force that we don't understand? And I came upon the idea of mass extinctions, which are indeed the worst kind of disaster that could ever happen to the planet. And the more that I researched them, the more that I read scientific papers and talked to scientists, I realized that actually one of the main characteristics of a mass extinction is that there are always survivors. And that was when I really began to change how I understood what this book was going to be about. So let me start by telling you a little bit about the destruction. A mass extinction is actually a scientific term of art, which refers to any event where more than 75% of all species on the planet die out. And usually these take about a million years. And so when you look at them, they're taking place in geological time. They're not a quick thing that we can see in a human lifetime. And one of the things that links pretty much all of the mass extinctions, and there have been five of them so far in Earth's history over the past half billion years or so, is that most of them are caused by climate change. So usually there's some horrific event that sets off the climate change. Maybe an asteroid hits the planet, which is what happened in the most recent and perhaps most famous mass extinction, which is the one that extinguished the dinosaurs 65 million years ago when an asteroid slammed into the planet. But of course, when that happened, actually, it wasn't like a Michael Bay movie. It wasn't like a big rock hit the planet and there was like fire and like dinosaurs were being like barbecued. And although that sounds really cool, there were no lasers or anything like that. What actually happened was, of course, where the asteroid hit, there were horrific fires and creatures were killed by the thousands. But over time, the ejecta from the asteroid worked its way into the atmosphere and changed the climate over the long term. And so actually what happened was most dinosaurs died out from the subsequent climate changes. And this is the case with, like I said, nearly all the mass extinctions. So let me tell you a little bit about my favorite mass extinction to give you an idea of how these work. Everyone kind of has a favorite mass extinction. If you talk to geologists about this, they always kind of, they have a gallows humor about it because, you know, these are horrific mass slayings of creatures. And so my personal favorite is the one that comes at the end of the Permian period. And if you look at this chart here of geological periods, you can see it kind of down near the bottom. And there's even a little thing that says gigantic extinction right next to the Permian. So this was about 250 million years ago. And at that time, the planet, due to plate tectonics, the continents were completely different than they are now. They were arranged into one giant supercontinent, Pangaea. So you have to imagine a supercontinent sort of stretching all the way from the North Pole down to the South Pole. And that was when, in the north, so basically, in the north, the area that eventually became Siberia began to turn into a supervolcano. And what happens in a supervolcano is not a scientific term, but it basically refers to a massive, massive volcano. And this was a volcano caused by an igneous province, which is just a very large area where lava is being released in multiple places. So you have to imagine great big vents opening up in the earth. It's not like a mountain where it's kind of blowing up on the top. It's big vents opening up, kind of like the Iceland volcano that we saw recently. And they just start extruding lava, big waves of lava. So again, it's not explosive, it's just lava oozing out of these huge cracks and vents. And there's multiple vents. And so in this northern area of Pangaea, this event went on for about, let's say 1,000 years. So it was a 1,000-year eruption. And what happened was, over time, the gases and ash that were released from that volcanic eruption were kind of like a super industrial revolution. They were releasing so much carbon into the environment that the climate first started to cool down, and then it heated up into a super greenhouse, and the oceans became very acidic, and creatures died out in incredible numbers. It was the worst mass extinction that the planet has ever seen. And by the end of that million-year period, 95% of all species on the planet had died out. Even insects died out, which is very unusual. You don't usually see insect deaths in a mass extinction. But it was sea creatures, land creatures, plants. Everybody was screwed by that volcano. But there was one survivor on land who kind of is the creature that actually turned me around on mass extinction and made me think about them in a new way. And it was a creature who is related to a group of animals that later evolved into mammals. So it was kind of a mammal-like creature. Think of it as kind of the uncle of humanity. Not our direct ancestor. And its name is Lystrosaurus. And Lystrosaurus had a couple of traits that made it an excellent survivor in this incredibly difficult time in Earth's history. It was somewhat small. It was about a dog size. It was about 3 feet long, 2 to 3 feet long. Looks like a little bit like a pig and a little bit like a lizard. And they were burrowers. So you have to imagine them eating kind of the way pigs do, like probably eating tubers and roots. And they probably burrowed in the evening. So they would dig a burrow. They had very powerful front legs. And so they were digging out holes and living underground a lot. So for Lystrosaurus, it was kind of awesome when the volcano started going off, because the whole world was kind of transformed into Lystrosaurus heaven, because they were used to being underground and breathing kind of dirty air anyway. They had a great lung capacity, which means that possibly they were able to get more oxygen from dirty air than other creatures that were similar in size. And the other thing about Lystrosaurus was that a lot of its natural predators died during the early Triassic, which was the period that followed the Permian. So it had no predators, it had dirty air, all of its food sources were mostly underground, so if the sunlight is blocked and temperatures are changing, that food source is probably going to be mostly unharmed by that transition. But one of the other things that Lystrosaurus did was it scattered across the southern continent. So remember, this is a huge supercontinent. Lystrosaurus moved from a more northern region all the way down into the south. And this is over a period of millions of years. And scattered across that continent, speciated, in other words, evolved into many different species, maybe possibly four, possibly more, and adapted to new ecological niches. It did two of the things that I talk about in the title of my book. It scattered and adapted. It fled from the source of danger, which was this supervolcano, and learned how to live in new places. And, you know, this humble little weird-faced guy sort of became my mascot when I was working on this book. I guess I traded in Godzilla as my mascot and picked up Lystrosaurus, because this creature was, as I said, he was very humble, and yet nevertheless it managed to make it through the toughest time in Earth's history while all of these other creatures around it were suffering because their food webs were unraveling. And this is a major cause of mass extinction. A food web is just a way of talking about the networks of basically who eats whom in an ecosystem. And what happens if you have a food web where a lot of creatures start going extinct is that it causes knock-on extinctions among other creatures who perhaps eat them. So if your food source dies, you die too. So whenever you have, that's kind of one of the ways that mass extinctions get started, is you have a few die-offs, and then you get all these knock-on mass extinction situations, knock-on extinctions that cause the 75% number. So there's one thing that we can do as humans that Lystrosaurus can't really do, or probably couldn't do. So we have the ability in a crisis to basically do what Lystrosaurus did, which is adapt to new environments. Humans have been terrific at doing that. We've managed to, at different points in history, flee from danger when we've been lucky. But we also have a form of memory that goes way beyond just remembering what happened yesterday. It goes way beyond remembering, hey, if I want to go to sleep tonight, I need to dig a hole in the ground the way Lystrosaurus did. Humans can remember not just their own lifetimes, but we can use history to remember the whole of our civilization's history. We can use scientific fields like anthropology and geology to actually look back and consider the whole history of our evolution as a species, as well as the evolution of the planet, and look at all of the disasters that have happened and learn from them. And that's a very profound survival skill. And like I said, it's something that, as far as we know, is fairly unique to human beings as a species. We haven't found any other species that seem to be able to do that yet. And so part of my hope in sort of the center of writing this book, when I realized it wasn't going to be all destruction and there was going to be some hope of survival, is that we actually have the traits of a survivor species like Lystrosaurus, plus we have this added ability to plan for the future. And that is really important, and I spend a lot of time in the book talking about ways that we can start planning for the future, basing those plans on what we know of disasters that have already happened to humans, but also disasters that have happened to the Earth, because that's really important in planning, is learning from history and learning from the great experiment that is human evolution and human civilization. So let me put this in perspective for you. Human beings are mammals, which is why we're so cute and furry and we have live babies and all those good things, just like these cute cats up here. And the typical species lifespan for a mammal, in other words, the typical amount of time before the species evolves into another species or dies out, is 1 million years. That's a typical species lifespan. And humans, Homo sapiens, evolved about 100,000 years ago, possibly 200,000, depending on kind of where you sit in the anthropological debate over this question. But the fact is, either way, we're pretty early in our species timeline. We've only got, you know, say 900,000 years left to go. So when we're thinking about planning for the future as a species, planning for our survival as Homo sapiens, we need to be thinking not just of what are we going to do next month or next week, but how are we going to set things up so that we have a good experience living for another 900,000 years. What can we do now? What can we think about doing as a species? What kinds of projects can we take on to make those 900,000 years really awesome instead of, you know, living like cannibals underground and turning into zombies?
Anna Lee Newitz, the author of Scatter, Adapt, and Remember: How Humans Will Survive a Mass Extinction. She spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on May 22, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of her talk by going to kuow.org/programs/speakers-forum. Cameron Drews recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
More from Anna Lee Newitz in a moment. Just about 8:22 now, 94.9 KUOW. A wealthy Canadian who died in 2004 wanted close to $1 million from his estate gifted to an American neo-Nazi group. Hear an American lawyer talk about trying to stop the transfer later this evening. Also, one woman talks about being struck by lightning in Saskatchewan and about this being the second time she's been struck by lightning. Conservative MP Russ Hebert looks for sinister motives after some Harper conservative senators take the union's side against his labor bill. Miami Herald journalist Audra Birch offers her observations of the trial of George Zimmerman over the shooting death of Trayvon Martin last year. All of those items in the 11 o'clock hour tonight. Weather outlook for the Seattle area for tonight: lows around 60, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers this evening, partly cloudy with patchy fog after midnight. Friday's prediction: highs 70s to lower 80s, mostly sunny skies, some patchy fog in the morning. Looking ahead to Friday night, lows around 60, mostly clear. Saturday, highs around 80 and mostly sunny.
KUOW and ACT Theater present An Evening with Groucho. The audience becomes part of the show as Frank Ferrante improvises his way through this comedy in true Groucho style. And no two shows are ever the same. June 13th through the 30th. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. A mass extinction occurs when more than 75% of species die out in under 2 million years. According to science journalist Anna Lee Newitz, our planet is long overdue for a catastrophe that could lead to another extinction. But humans' chances for survival might be better now than ever before. Newitz spoke at Town Hall on May 22, 2013.
In my book, I talk about two kinds of very long-term plans that we can start working on now and that we can share with coming generations for the next several millennia and more. And the first area that I'm most interested in is cities and city building and city planning. And the reason why is right now, the vast majority of humans, well, not the vast majority, the majority of humans, more than 50%, live in cities. And the UN has done some predictions on how that trend will continue. And if things go pretty much as they have been, we're looking at possibly as many as 67 or 70% of people living in cities in 50 years. So people are becoming more and more urban. The majority of humanity is going to be located in cities. So as we're thinking about the future, a good place to focus on ways to make our lives more survivable is the city. And there's different ways that we can tackle making cities more survivable. First of all, we need to be thinking about how do you make a city robust against disaster. And there's a lot of different things we can do, from better earthquake engineering, and that's one thing that I talk about a lot in the book because I'm from San Francisco, where we deal with earthquakes all the time. Of course, here you guys also live in a subduction zone, so Seattle probably should be thinking about earthquakes a lot too. And we also need to be thinking about things that are a little bit more ephemeral and social, like how do you organize a city's evacuation plan in a flood? Or how do you organize how to respond to a pandemic that hits your city? That may not have to do with how you engineer the city, but it has to do with how you engineer the social infrastructure of the city. And it turns out there are a lot of myths about how to handle pandemics in a city that are not really true. And that was very interesting for me to find out about. One of the really interesting areas, and this is going to get a little bit futuristic, that I really think could help cities become not just more disaster-proof, but also more sustainable, is a movement that's just started now that is called living architecture. It goes by some other names too, like bioarchitecture. And it's basically a combination of architectural designs that imitate nature, but also materials science that creates new kinds of building materials that behave like living substances, or actually are partly made of living substances. One of the best examples of this is something that's called self-healing concrete. Again, not a scientific term, it's just a phrase that's used for a lot of different kinds of substances. What you can see here in the slide is one experiment that was done a few years ago by some students who invented a substance that was partly made from bacteria. These were genetically modified bacteria that when they were put into a crack in concrete, and you can see here, there was a sort of on the left side, there's the crack, and this is magnified, by the way, and they put this substance that they referred to as Bacilla phylla, because they used Bacilla bacteria. I'm glad you guys are laughing because you're a science crowd. Like, yeah, I know what that means. Anyway, so they made some Bacilla phylla, and basically this bacteria, the Bacilla, would go into the crack, and then because it had been modified, it would extrude this epoxy, as well as some other kind of calcium-like substances, and eventually fill in the crack, holding onto the concrete and leaving behind this kind of scar that it actually looks like a kind of living skin that has healed up. And of course, the important part of this experiment and all experiments with synthetic biology architecture is that the bacteria are they are set up, engineered to die when they're done with their filling in the crack. So there's a fail-safe mechanism. So they fill it in, give their lives to heal the concrete. And this is just one example of a self-healing material that could be used in cities. I talked to architects and designers for this book about much more futuristic ideas for how these kinds of materials might be used. Self-healing materials, of course, make housing more sustainable, because instead of tearing down old structures, the structures might heal themselves. It also can make things like bridges more safe, because if they develop cracks, they may be able to heal themselves before a real disaster happens. And so we might be able to have self-healing structures that are maintaining themselves just like living organisms. And the city itself can become a kind of living organism, helped by this kind of biological innovation, but also, of course, helped by things like, you know, a smart grid that really works. And if you have a smart grid that really works, where, say, a building sips just enough power from the grid to supply what it needs, while other buildings that don't need power don't sip any power from the grid, you're creating a kind of organism where the buildings are kind of talking to each other on the grid and agreeing who's going to get power when, and you start having almost like a body where, you know, different organs are getting blood or getting nutrients when they need them. And so it's my idea, and the idea of a lot of architects and designers working in this space, that cities are going to slowly become more like organisms, and that this will allow us to have, hopefully, carbon neutral or even carbon negative cities where we're ultimately using alternative fuels, maybe growing fuels. Maybe cities would be full of algae vats, or every home would have its own algae vat, and you could use that algae for fuel. You might use the algae also for lighting. You could have genetically modified algae that would glow in the dark. And I talked to one designer who's really interested in living architecture, and she said, you know, in 100 or 200 years, we might be cultivating mold in our houses, not killing it. And you'd be exchanging recipes with your neighbors for, like, how do you get the best mold to, like, purify your water and light up at night? And so our cities might not be as much in contradiction with nature and in contradiction with the environments where they are. And one day you might look out on your city and see something that looks kind of like a ruin or like a treehouse. And you'd come across these kind of crumbling structures and realize, actually, a crumbling structure, a structure covered in vines, might really be a living place. It might look like it was crumbling because it had been, self-healing. And so these buildings would be covered in scars and bumpy, and they wouldn't look all smooth and sexy like downtown Seattle does now, but they might be a lot more sustainable and a lot better for the people in them and the environment. And ultimately, and again, looking further into the future, even further than biological cities, we might start extending our ability to farm our cities and build our cities using organic materials and start actually farming the atmosphere. And when I say farming the atmosphere, I choose those words because we've used farming to pretty much transform the surface of the earth. We now are kind of shepherds of almost everything that grows on the planet, except for some areas, and even those areas are kind of falling under human control. And ultimately, if we want to maintain the climate at a level that we prefer, we're going to have to start thinking about how are we going to control the climate? Because it's not going to be enough just to cut carbon emissions. Obviously, we need to do that. That's a great start. But the planet goes through carbon cycles naturally. As I was talking about with the Permian period, there's absolutely times when the planet is going to create the results of an industrial revolution without any help from us. It's going to have mega volcanoes, carbon will be introduced into the atmosphere and heat things up all by itself. We don't need to be there to do it. So humans are going to have to take on the burden or take on the project of actually keeping the environment in a state that we prefer. Having those ice caps on the North and South Poles, that's great for us, right? We love it. We like it to be kind of cold. All the animals and plants in our environment are kind of set up and evolved for that. But that's actually kind of weird in the history of the planet. Most of the history of the planet, there have been no ice caps at the poles. Things have been a lot warmer. The atmosphere at times has been much more carbon rich. Sometimes it's been much more oxygen rich. And so it's quite unnatural for us to be hoping to keep the planet in a state where it's nice and cool the way we like it. So eventually, over time, if we want our species to enjoy life on Earth, we're going to have to think about what kinds of technologies we can invent to draw carbon down out of the atmosphere when it naturally starts getting in there through either through stuff that we've done, which one could argue is not very natural, or just through the natural carbon cycles of the planet. And so that would be, those technologies are geoengineering technologies, ways of engineering the entire geology of the Earth. And I do talk about that in the book as well, and I won't give you too many spoilers, but trust me, it's a long way off. There have been some geoengineering experiments that have happened actually quite recently. There was a rogue geoengineer off the coast of Canada who did an experiment trying to draw down carbon from the atmosphere by doing iron seeding in the ocean, and so far it doesn't seem as if it worked out. The idea is you put iron in the ocean, and it attracts microbes that like to eat iron, and then those microbes also draw down carbon, and when they die, hopefully they sink to the bottom of the ocean and take the carbon with them. The problem is they don't tend to sink all the way to the bottom of the ocean, so you end up with more carbon. So that's just a start, though, and geoengineering is really in its infancy. And finally, if we really want to look long-term beyond biological cities, beyond geoengineering, there's still going to be problems with Earth. For one thing, we have this habit of running into giant rocks in space because we are a giant rock hanging in space. And there's other rocks out here with us, and gravity brings us into contact sometimes. And we also, of course, have a planet which is full of magma, and volcanoes happen, sometimes for a really long time and sometimes really catastrophically. So if we want, again, to have our awesome million years and hopefully beyond, we need to be thinking about how to get off the planet. We need to be thinking about how humans can have backup cities and new civilizations on other planets and maybe other structures in space, because if something catastrophic happens to the planet, we need to have a place where we can go be refugees. Maybe we all are going to be Venusian refugees at some point. Hopefully the Venusian government won't mind. Well, maybe we'll have to go to Mars or Mercury. I heard like there's a lot of jobs on Mercury right now, so they're like, it's like Saskatchewan. They're like, come on, we'll take any refugee. The thing is that when we think about space travel and when we think about colonizing space, it may turn out to take a little bit longer than we think. We're kind of taking our first baby steps towards space travel, but let me just give you a quick example of how that timeline might work. Looking back into human history, humans 50,000 years ago used reed boats, much like this one that you're seeing over here, to get from Asia to Australia. 50,000 years ago, we crossed an entire ocean in reed boats. But it wasn't really until about 500 years ago that you had international travel using boats, creating a global culture. It was not until really the advent of, tremendous amounts of capital being poured into shipping as part of the colonization of the planet that you really got kind of, like I said, a global culture. So that's a lot of lag time between the first use of boats to go from one continent to the other to creating a culture where humans are traveling all the time between the continents. So if you think of this first boat here as the rockets that we've used to get to the moon and the rockets we've used to take our robot friends to Mars, we may be pretty far away from a time when we're jetting between Mars and Earth all the time. I hope it's not going to be 50,000 years. I don't mean to suggest that, we're going to have to wait that long. But it may be a lot longer than we hope. It may not be next decade or next century that we have a city on Mars. It may take us hundreds of years before we really have a space-going civilization. And it may look nothing like what we expect. We may not be using rockets to get off the planet. We may be using something like this space elevator here. A space elevator is actually, it's great that I'm in Seattle because every year there is a space elevator conference in Seattle. Where people who want to build it come and discuss their ideas. And since the 1990s, when NASA actually worked on a model for the space elevator and thought through some of the things that we might need to create one, NASA has actually had an annual prize offered to anyone who can build part of this elevator that doesn't exist yet. And I'll tell you about that in just a second. As you can see, this image is actually from NASA. And what you can see here is the elevator car. There's Earth very far in the background. And the idea of a space elevator, first of all, is it's answering a basic question, which is how do you have sustainable space travel? Because right now we're using rockets, which require rocket fuel, which is expensive, heavy, and polluting. And there's a limited supply of it. So it's not a good long-term solution. We can't keep using rockets to get out of the gravity well. So what would we use? How would we have a kind of train into space that would be completely able to be used over and over again, something that wouldn't pollute the environment? So the space elevator. And this is how it works. So you have a platform on Earth. You have your elevator platform somewhere along the equator. And then you have a very, very long tether attaching that elevator platform up about 60,000 miles. So you're partway to the moon at that point. And at the other end of that tether, you have a counterweight. And that counterweight is in geostationary orbit. So it's orbiting the Earth, but also attached by this tether. I'll get to the tether in a minute, because the tether is kind of the problem. And right now, we actually have the technology to do a lot of this. The counterweight, not so much. The counterweight might be, say, a captured asteroid. It might be a happy version of the Death Star. Basically, what it's going to be is a port. It's going to be a destination for people to get to in space where they can then get onto a spaceship that will take them somewhere else. So the space elevator is just to get you out of the gravity well into space and then on your merry way. It'll take you about 3 days to get up to that counterweight or port. So the car isn't really like an elevator as you would think of it today. It's more like a train sleeper car. You're going to probably have a crappy bunk bed that'll cost a lot of money. But hopefully it'll be much, much cheaper than the amount of money that it costs now to get into space. And of course, you can use the elevator car over and over again. And you can have people going constantly up and down, and of course, supplies going up and down as well. And the idea is that the elevator car would climb up that tether using robotic arms of the kind that exist now in industrial factories to build large machines. So you have your robotic arms pulling this elevator car out of the gravity well of Earth and into space. The big question is, what would you make the tether out of? It has to be flexible and thin. It has to withstand weather. It has to withstand micrometeorites that are zooming around in space. It has to withstand the space junk that we've put into the atmosphere, although maybe by the time we build this, we'll have like a space vacuum that's gotten rid of all the space junk, or we'll have like robots up there that are collecting space junk. It's been suggested that it might be made out of carbon nanotubes, but it's unclear whether carbon nanotubes could really be used for something like this. But like I said, every year NASA has a contest where they offer up to $1 million to anyone who can come up with a substance that would be strong enough and light enough to be that ribbon. So far, no one has actually won the full amount, although people are working on the carbon nanotube angle. And if you have an idea for it, then you should go to the Space Elevator Conference and see if you can help create the future of space travel. The point is that things in the future might not look exactly the way we expect. We've got, like I said, 900,000 years to change and develop new technologies that will hopefully make the future a place where we can survive, disasters from everyday stuff like earthquakes and tsunamis to really mass extinction-causing disasters like supervolcanoes or encounters with asteroids from space. And the thing is that, as I said, no matter what happens, humans are probably going to survive. If we look even dispassionately at geological history and at human history, we see that humans do have all the traits that are required to survive even a really horrific disaster, even a mass extinction. The question is just how we're going to survive. What kinds of projects will we start taking on as a species to make our survival something that is enjoyable or something that is sustainable and not turn into a horrific scenario where we have to live underground eating worms all the time, which I don't mean to poop on eating worms. I think that's great, but I don't want to do it every day. Humans have a survival instinct like every other creature on the planet. So the fact is that no matter if we're good or bad, if we're bad to the planet or good to it, we are going to make it through. We're going to survive. It's just a question of how weird it's going to get, how different it's going to get. And at some point, I think we may evolve into an entirely different species, after that 1 million years is up. And, say we wind up as part squid, part cyborg creatures, living on a moon of Saturn. That's a win for us. We don't have to be human at the end of that journey. We may change a lot over that time. And we, hopefully, our progeny, our squid cyborg progeny, will look back at us and say, like, good job, you guys. That was a great path that you took. You helped us survive, and now we have an awesome home on Titan. So, again, like I said, that's a win for us. And I think it's going to get weird, but we are going to make it through. Thanks very much.
Anna Lee Newitz, the author of Scatter, Adapt, and Remember, How Humans Will Survive a Mass Extinction. She spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on May 22, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of her talk by going to kuow.org/programs/speakers-forum. Cameron Drews recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
More from Anna Lee Newitz in a moment. 845 94.9 KUOW. A conversation about the long-term effects of this week's historic Supreme Court rulings tonight at midnight. The U.S. Preventative Services Task Force, an influential group of independent specialists who are appointed by the federal government, have concluded that all baby boomers should get screened at least once for hepatitis C, regardless of risk factors. Many people who carry the blood infection show no symptoms for many years. As one ages, hepatitis C can cause a variety of serious liver problems, including cancer. Why is it so important for boomers to get tested? Dr. Jeff Duchin is chief of epidemiology at Seattle King County Public Health. We'll talk with him about the matter tomorrow during the noon hour. Lows around 60 tonight for the Seattle area. Mostly cloudy with a chance of showers this evening. Partly cloudy with patchy fog after midnight. Friday highs 70s to lower 80s. Mostly sunny after patchy fog in the morning, that is. Looking ahead to Friday night, lows around 60, mostly clear. Saturday highs around 80 degrees, mostly sunny. A conversation about the unique issues the transgender community faces coming up in just a bit. Also, Seattle fisheries scientist and poet Peter Monroe reads his poem, Reading My Father's Bible, a reflection on caring for a dying parent. And a conversation about how a person's speech, or about how a person can change his or her speech depending on who they're talking to. All three of these items next hour, beginning right after the 9 o'clock news.
KUOW and the Shoreline Lake Forest Park Arts Council present the 23rd Shoreline Arts Festival, celebrating the creativity of artists and diverse cultures on June 29th and 30th. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Anna Lee Newitz is a journalist and editor of the science website io9.com. She's also the author of Scatter, Adapt, and Remember, How Humans Will Survive a Mass Extinction. She spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on May 22, 2013. Next, she takes questions from the audience.
Hi, so one of the things, we adapt, scatter, and remember, but I'm sure everybody's reading books on these things. What happens when the power goes out? How do you read? What happens to the books, the libraries?
Well, the libraries are made of paper. So there's a lot of answers to that question. Humans, luckily, do have a lot of redundant storage mechanisms. We don't just use, terabyte RAID arrays like I use at my house for perfectly legal stores of media. We also do have books. There's also a lot of groups who organize online, actually, who are working on creating storehouses of knowledge that can be printed out and used in the event of civilizational collapse. There's also the possibility that we could, maintain some of those archives with generators. It really depends on what the collapse is. Because a lot of these disasters, we imagine the giant fireball, or if any of you are watching the show Revolution, it's going to be like Google is going to invent nanotechnology that destroys the electrical grid, or anyway, don't watch that show. The point is that most of these disasters that I'm looking at are things that don't happen instantaneously. So they're kind of a slow-moving disaster that kind of picks up speed over hundreds of thousands of years. And even when you have something like, say, an earthquake or tsunami or even a bombing, even a radiation disaster, those tend to be localized. So you're always going to have pockets where people have information. And what humans are great at is sharing information over distances. So even if there's a time period where, some people, like in Seattle and San Francisco, we don't have the internet and we all stab our eyes out because we can't even imagine what that would be like. There's probably other people out there who are going to maintain those information stores, and we will have libraries. We will have backups.
Thanks.
So what's the best thing that we can do to ensure the survival of the human race?
Well, I've been talking about some of that today. I think that the main question is, how do we conceive of what we're doing as being part of a long-term pathway to survival? Because all of these threats take place over many, many generations. And that's very hard for us to think about because we're used to thinking about, well, what can I do tomorrow to fix something next week? And these are things that we can do in a human lifetime to fix things for people living 300 years from now. So the real question is, how do we conceive of a project like rebuilding our cities to be more like biological organisms in a way that isn't frustrating? Because obviously, well, in my lifetime, I'm never going to see that. In my lifetime, I'm never going to see a space elevator except if I'm playing a video game. So how do we have steps along the way? Like, how do we invent a technology in our lifetime that can add to a future where we have biological cities? And that's why I'm really excited about things like self-healing materials, which are something that we can invent in a lifetime, that we can even maybe perfect in a lifetime, and that could be part of a pathway toward having a more sustainable city. And so I think that's really the difficult task, is realizing you won't get to see the end of the story in your lifetime. You know, you won't get to have the happy moment of like, and then we survived, because you're only going to know that at the end of a million years. So you have to just hope that, like I said, our like cyborg squid offspring say like, wow, thanks you guys. You know, the same way like we look back at Homo erectus and we're like, good job with like the whole fire thing, right? Oh my God, flake tools? Good job! So I think that has to be the hope, is that we kind of get bite-sized projects that we can do in a lifetime and go to space.
Well, you've actually already started answering my question. I was wondering, you know, humans, as you said, are uniquely able to learn from history, but also haven't shown much inclination to learn from history. So how are you going to motivate people to start down this path of things that will be useful to us a million years from now, or even 1,000 years from now?
Yeah, or even 100 years from now, right? So I always find it funny that people say, you know, humans are so bad at learning from history, or we're so lazy, like nobody's motivated to do anything. And the fact is that if you look at humans on that bigger timeline, like look at us as a species, don't look at us as like your brother or like your professors or whatever, like just an individual person who's like a total idiot for their whole life. You have to look at it as a really long-term narrative. So again, we're very early in that narrative. And also, just take something like climate change. Okay, when did humanity figure out that the stuff that we're doing with our industrial production is causing climate change? About, 20, if you wanted to be generous, you could say 30 years or 40 years. So in our lifetimes, we figured that out. And during that time, it's become one of the most hotly debated political issues on the planet. And that's pretty good. No, we haven't fixed it. And in fact, you know, many would argue that we're screwing things up even worse. But the fact is that just in the short period of time since we figured out that we were screwing up, we've turned it into something where it's a huge question of how we're going to deal with it. And so again, it's frustrating because probably all of us will be dead before we find out, you know, who prevails and what the alternative energy will be that we finally use instead of fossil fuels. You know, will it be corn? Please no. Will it be solar? That's what I'm hoping for, because solar is a really great technology that's just in its infancy. And so really, I think our track record is pretty good. I feel like we've learned a lot from disasters that have happened historically, and that we are weirdly pretty agile at responding. It's just that it isn't within a lifetime. You know, it's like if you look back at the last 500 years, it's, you know, there have been really awesome things that humans have done and learned from. You know, now we have science as an incredibly widely accepted theory of dealing with the world, not everywhere, but in most places. And that was also quite recent. So I guess I feel like humans are doing okay. I think we're muddling through. You know, we're not the greatest, sometimes we're jerks, but I think on the whole, we actually, that urge to adapt and the urge to survive does percolate out into our politics and into our social structures. But again, it takes a little time. So,
thanks.
Yeah, thank you.
Hi. So you mentioned that there were communities online where they're accumulating basically storehouses of knowledge to be printed off in emergency circumstances.
Yeah.
Do you happen to know the names of any of those organizations?
I do talk about them in my book. There's one group that is, you're going to have to Google on this. They're basically, it's like 3CD, something like that, because they basically all of the knowledge is on 3 CDs. And it's stuff like how do you do basic medicine, how do you do basic farming techniques. There's also a helpful section on how men lead the family. So there's sometimes a little bit of an ideological problem with each of these projects. But there's other projects. There's a group that has... They're trying to come up with a fairly small number of machines that you would need to restart civilization. And so it's everything from like a threshing machine to a 3D printer, actually. MakerBot will survive the apocalypse, which is great news. And there's other groups doing it as well. And I think, you know, if you kind of can put all the information together from all those groups, it can be interesting. But again, you always have to think about, like, what is the threat model here? Like, there always seems to be this go-to scenario for humans where we say, everything is going to collapse. Like, you know, because we're not going to have the internet anymore, we're not going to have any power, the cities will be, I don't know what supposedly is going to happen to the cities. Maybe they'll all be nuked out of existence. And so we'll have to start with, like, men leading the charge into the, you know, agricultural economy again. And I don't mean to pick on these poor guys. They're trying their best. And they did amass like an incredible amount of really helpful information. But the fact is that there's not a lot of disasters that are like that, where you just see a complete, you know, loss of every kind of new technology. So I think, as I said when I began, the apocalypse is a lot more complicated than we think it will be. And there will be pockets of people who have access to high technology. And even today on the planet, there's people who have access to high technology that many, many people in the world don't have access to. And so the apocalypse may look a lot like the world does now, just slightly worse. And so we have to be prepared for that. Yes, just a little bit worse. And very slow. And that's part of why we really do need to be trying to take action now to kind of slowly, gently steer us away from the slightly worse but complicated world. So, but yeah, if you find other stuff, email me and let me know, other resources.
Anna Lee Newitz, the author of Scatter, Adapt, and Remember, How Humans Will Survive a Mass Extinction. She spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on May 22nd, 2013, You can learn more and hear the whole hour of her talk by going to kuow.org/programs/speakers-forum. Cameron Drews recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Join KUOW for Bumbershoot, featuring 3 days of art, comedy, and music at Seattle Center this Labor Day weekend. The 2013 lineup includes local band Death Cab for Cutie, playing transatlanticism, heart, and more. Learn more on the events page at kuow.org.
859 KUOW FM 94.9 Seattle, 1340 KUOW Tumwater, 90.3 KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. I'm Bill O'Grady. Today's KUOW Day sponsors are Craig Lee and Sandra Tassel, celebrating American Friends of Canadian Land Trust's first BC land conservation gift. And Eileen Schwartz extending heartfelt thanks to the families, staff, teachers, and supporters of the Experimental Education Unit at the University of Washington's Herring Center. And support for KUOW comes from the Seattle Aquarium, announcing the opening of the new Harbor Seal exhibit.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.